Well, thank you, Dwayne, for your comments this morning, and John for the songs that he picked out. Great to see you this morning on this week leading up to Thanksgiving, and for some of you visiting with us, and for some that we haven't seen in some time, Saeed is with us, and it's great to have Saeed visiting with us. Just glad you're here. From time to time, believers, and I'm not sure for the first generation of believers that have ever been told this, but we're told that if we continue following the Bible and hold to Bible principles, that we're going to find ourselves on the wrong side of history. That if we continue to press the Bible's viewpoint on something, that future generations are going to look back at us and say, what a bunch of knuckleheads, what a bunch of bumpuses, what a bunch of ignorant, misguided people. Is that history is going to judge us that way. And there's a number of passages. There's the passage in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. Let marriage be held in honor among all, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. That if we continue to hold to that principle, that history is not going to view us in a favorable light. Or passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor the effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. That if we hold to those passages and believe those passages, that in the future, history is not going to view us in a very kindly manner. One of the problems that I find with this idea of you're going to end up on the wrong side of history is, to me, one of the weaknesses of the argument is the assumption that what most people believe at a certain point in time establishes truth. And there's a number of passages in the Bible that I remember, that I recall, where if you wanted to run the numbers game, if you were in the numbers, is that the Bible is not really into numbers, as far as big numbers. One of them would be Matthew chapter 7:13, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. The gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. And that God's not really concerned about what the many think. God's concerned about the many being saved, but God is not concerned about what they think or believe. That is, that their position does not establish truth. That the broad way is where most people are, and that's the way of wrong viewpoints. In fact, in verse 22, Jesus says, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and your name cast out demons, and your name perform many miracles? He says, then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that practice lawlessness. That reduces it to another level. That is, not only is the world's perspective wrong, but Jesus, I think, argues there that pretty much the perspective of the religious world is wrong too. Is that on the last day, many people come up to Jesus and say, but I'm a Christian, I believe, and he's going to say, you're lost. I never knew you. You never were a Christian to begin with. That is, even the viewpoint of the denominational world out there, even their viewpoint at times is not the truth. And so we need to study our Bibles and have our Bibles open. But there's a couple other passages, like the book of 1 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 20, Noah and the flood. Who once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, and then I like this, that is, eight persons, that's the few. The few are eight, were brought safely through the water. And yet, there may have been 16 million people on the planet, and that's a conservative estimate of people on the planet. Maybe been far more than that, but only eight out of millions are saved during the flood. All right. I'm reminded also of 1 Corinthians 10, verse 5, where it talks about the generation that came out of Egyptian bondage. They were all baptized into Moses. They all ate the same spiritual food. They all had the same spiritual drink, access to it. They all had the manna. They all drank water that came from the rock miraculously. And then he says, and Jesus was with them. The rock that followed them was Christ. And then it says in verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. That is, of all the men of military age, only two actually got to come into the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. So there's another numbers game. But outside of that, how about 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 22, when the prophets of Baal and Elijah are assembled on Mount Carmel. And here's what Elijah says. Verse 22, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Baal has 450 prophets. And there are more than that that are added to Baal's prophets. And Elijah said, I'm the only prophet of the Lord. And yet Elijah was the one on the right side. Romans chapter 9, verse 27 is another passage. And this gets it smaller than the world. This gets it to, like, what about even Israel? Just the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. Isaiah cries out concerning Israel. Though the number of the sons of Israel be like the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved. Even in Israel in the Old Testament, the vast majority of people were not right with God. But there was a faithful few. And in Elijah's time, God said, there are 7,000 men that have not bowed the knee to Baal. But how about this? Romans 10:21. Here's what Isaiah said about the people he preached to during his lifetime. All the day long, I've stretched out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. Even in Israel, most of them were wrong-headed. And how about Isaiah 53, verse 1? Isaiah says somewhat the counterpart of this verse. Lord, who has believed our report? Not many. Not many people have accepted the Lord's report, even among God's professed people. Okay, next flaw. Next flaw in this idea, you'll end up on the wrong side of history. There's this assumption that at some point in the future, a generation is going to come to the right conclusion about past events. And it will be settled. There's a big problem with that. The next generation may get it completely wrong. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 10 is the passage that I want to take a look at on this particular point. If we're thinking that the next generation, they'll have it all figured out, and they will have the right view on all past events, don't get your hopes up. Here's what Solomon had observed. So then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place. So these are wicked people that are religious. These are wicked people that go to the temple. These are wicked people that go to worship services on a regular basis. Today they would say that they're wicked people that, you know, attend a church somewhere. And it says that he's seen them buried. That is, they were wicked, but they were religious. They were living a double life. All right, then he says this. And they are soon forgotten in the city where they did this. Now, that would be open. Don't think he's saying that the wicked people are forgotten, that is, they're forgotten. Because he says this to his futility, he's talking about something that's frustrating. It's not frustrating for wicked people to be forgotten. That's a good thing for wicked people to be forgotten. The thing is that what's forgotten about them is their wickedness. They're not remembered as wicked people. You ever been to a funeral of someone you know, and they were a scoundrel, and the guy went up and preached them into heaven, and you're looking around going like, did I come to the right? Is this the right place? I've been to funerals exactly like that, looking around like, are we talking about the guy that we all knew? Because I don't know who that guy's talking about, but he's not talking about the guy in that box up there. And that's what Solomon is frustrated about, is he says, here's what I've seen. Wicked people who are religious. And the community that they harmed and did all their bad deeds in, when they die, has forgotten how wicked they are, and at their funeral they're praised instead of exposed, like, you know, that was not a very nice person. And they're going to meet God in judgment, and I'm going to let God decide that. And that's the end of the service, right? I mean, that's all that we need to say. What is forgotten about them is their former wickedness. And one writer says, the verse informs us that secular history is not infallible. Now, don't get me wrong. There is such a thing as history. So, I mean, sometimes you go to college and people say, well, there's no such thing as history. No, there is history. Certain events actually really happen. But the thing that's not debated sometimes is the event. The thing that's debated is the meaning or interpretation of the event. That's sometimes what people get wrong. I mean, most people don't doubt that there was a Titanic and it really sunk, but there's kind of different views as far as why it sunk or what was its downfall. You know, those type of things. That's the thing that gets scrambled sometimes. And so it's not the date and it's not that the actual event happened, but it's more of what's the meaning of the event. Was it good or bad? At times, history has mistakenly labeled the wicked as righteous and labeled the righteous as wicked. And this shows that popular moral judgments can be totally astray, swayed by the evidence of success or failure, and construing heaven's patience as its approval. The dictator or corrupt tycoon may have bent the rules, it will be said, but after all, they got things done. They had flair, and they lived in style, and they did it their way. In our culture, we have idolized a good number of people who were very sinful. Our culture has done that. Our culture has placed people up on a pedestal that you would never want them to be your role model. We place people up on a pedestal that were completely a mess in their personal lives. And we have placed people up on a pedestal who did not treat other people very kindly, including their spouses. So, that's sad. One translation says this, and so I've seen wicked men carried to the tomb, and praised from the holy place, and lauded in the city where they'd acted thus. Next thing. Third flaw, you're going to be on the wrong side of history. The assumption is that at some point in the future, there will arise an official verdict, the official verdict, on some or all past historical events, and that this verdict will remain unchanged until the end of time or the end of human history. Yet even in my short lifetime of 60, coming up on 61 years, I have seen a number of major flip-flops in how people view historical past events. When I was little, the American military was viewed with great respect. I've seen it kind of go the opposite direction, where there's a number of people in our country that do not have a very high regard for the American military. Of course, when I was little, it was just after they'd saved the world in World War II and fought back the communists in Korea and things like that, is that, you know, they basically saved the world, and the reason that we could worship freely and etc. was because of all the men that had given their lives. When I was in school, there was a picture of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson in the room that we were in. Remember that unfinished picture where it was like he didn't have anything past his shoulders sort of thing? It was kind of that picture. And I've lived long enough to see that in certain aspects of the culture, the founding fathers are viewed as villains and not as heroes. I've seen the American pioneers viewed as heroes and then viewed as villains. At least the history I learned in school was of the heroic effort to come across the West and settle and things like that, all the things they went through on the Oregon Trail and those sort of things. I've seen individuals like Columbus admired and celebrated to where they're vilified. I've seen a future generation build a monument, name a building or street after someone, and then another generation comes along and changes the name on the building or street or tears down the statue. I've seen a country beaming with pride when their astronauts walked on the moon, only to see an increasing number of people today deny that we ever walked on the moon or that the earth is flat. And here's the thing that got me is that a number of people that believe the earth is flat also don't believe in space. Okay, that one really like, what do you mean you don't believe in? Yeah, no outer space? No space. Wow, okay. Okay, man, I'm having a hard time getting my mind around that one. Okay. I have seen a generation after the Second World War vowing to never forget certain events like the Holocaust or Pearl Harbor. And then a generation rises that does not even know much or anything about such events, denies it ever happened or that it was even that significant if it did. I think someone argued that the Holocaust was nothing more than just a little speck on German history. That's all it was, just this little speck on their history. And I've seen presidents that were popular during their term viewed differently years later. And I have seen presidents like George Bush that was vilified during his term, and now he's out of office. A lot of people consider him a pretty cool dude. And that's kind of been an interesting flip-flop in observing that. Not only that, but consider this reality. Future generations may not even care about what we consider to be the major events of our lifetime. Because after all, does the teapot dome scandal keep you up awake at night? Like, oh, that was a major event in American history, and I don't care at all about that. And me probably don't either. In fact, you maybe never even heard about it, but that was a major event in our past history. Okay. So, just kind of keep that in mind that a future generation may not even care about what happened in your lifetime. So, Solomon again notes this. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 11. Verse 9 starts out the section this way. That which has been is that which will be. That is, history tends to repeat itself. And that which has been done is that which will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. Fashion is like that. Where like you live to the 70s, the bell bottoms and things like that, and you see that coming back. There is no remembrance of earlier things, also of the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. Is that the, here, some people say this. Some people that are not believers have this idea. They'll say, I know there's no heaven, but that's okay because I will live on in my children. I will live on through my children. Or grandchildren. No, they will forget you. Can you name your great-great-great-grandfather? No, I don't even, one or two generations and I'm all tapped out or whatever. Unless you've done the serious genealogy type of thing. But we're not forgotten by God. The Lord knows those who are His. We're not forgotten by God. And so, one writer said, as for pining our hopes on posterity, in the end, posterity will have lost the faintest memory of us. This is particularly true in sports, where if you live during a time where you see somebody and you go like, man, no one's ever going to forget that person because they are the greatest this or that that ever played the game. Or sometimes you see this in music as well. No one ever is going to forget that group because they had such lasting impact that no one will ever forget them. And then, it's hard to believe too. It's really hard to believe when you went through it. But what you don't realize is that, like if you were born in the 60s, there were great athletes long before that, but you weren't concerned about them. You were concerned about the ones of your generation. But there were tremendous athletes that lived before them. There were tremendous athletes that lived in the first century that won great things in the Olympic Games, but no one remembers who they were. So just kind of keep that in mind. You know, the verdict on the past is really never settled. That's the thing that really I came to, is that I've lived long enough to realize that it's not necessarily, at least among men, it's not necessarily ever settled. It always is reopened. Romans 3:23, though, this remains the same. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Man remains a sinner, and all the old abuses and the darkness and the ugliness is going to continue to resurface. All right. Here's another one, though. I think the motive often behind the "you're going to end up on the wrong side of history" is that the next generation is going to view. If you hold to the view you hold to, in the next, 20 years from now, you're going to be viewed as a bumpus. Or let's face it, you're going to lose. You're going to lose, and it's only a matter of time that you're going to lose. Is that the entire momentum of human history is moving in this particular direction? And it's moving away from the things that you believe, Mr. and Mrs. Christian. It's moving away from that. And if you don't get on the bandwagon now, you're going to be left behind. You're going to be left in the dust. And you're going to be viewed as horribly antiquated. And if your churches don't get on board, your churches are going to die out because no one's going to want to go where you attend. Now, we're probably not the first generation of Christians to hear that. The idea that if we don't get up with the times, we're going to die out. May I suggest to you, though, that that argument to me is blackmail. It's kind of a blackmail argument. And I think it's a way to try to get us to surrender prematurely. You might as well just surrender now. You might as well just give up. You might as well just conform to the world now, because everyone is going in this particular direction. It could be on this or that issue, or this world view. Question: what if believers in the past had bought into that? What if Joseph had thrown in the towel? Potiphar's wife is pressuring him. What if, she made the argument, "You might as well just realize I'm going to win and you're going to lose." And what if he had given up? Well, maybe we have, God can certainly bring about deliverance from someone else, but we would not have the story of Joseph, and Joseph would have not have had his amazing life. What if when Daniel got to Babylon in Daniel chapter 1, and he's given a new name, and he's taught everything about the Babylonian point of view, and their perspective, and their world view, what if they'd said, "Daniel, might as well just throw in the towel right now, and you might as well just conform right now, because eventually we're going to wear you down, and you're going to lose. Because everyone here believes something different than you do. And your people are like an enslaved people now. And Jerusalem is in ruins. And you guys are all... You're done. You're done." What if Daniel had bought into that? Well, we would not have the amazing story of Daniel either. Daniel chapter 1 verse 8. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's dainties. And Daniel may have never been told, "You're going to lose." But Daniel certainly was under pressure to conform, to fit in, to become like the rest of us, to believe like the rest of us. What about Moses? Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. What if Moses was told, "Moses, you might as well just stay with us, because that's a slave people, they have no future, and the future's with Egypt. We're the world empire. Those people are not, they don't look anything like a world empire. You might as well just throw in the towel and realize." Egypt could have argued this: "Moses, Egypt is the future. Did those people look like the future? They don't even appreciate your help. Daniel, Babylon's the future. Look at Israel. It's in ruins. Jerusalem, the temple's in ruins. They're not the future." And yet, all of those people were wrong. Egypt was not the future. Israel was the future. And Babylon was not the future either, because God had made a promise that he would bring a remnant out of captivity. The future was not in Egypt, and the future was not in Babylon. And, sometimes the church, maybe every generation of Christian has kind of heard this, you're going to die out, you're going to die out, you're going to die out. But isn't it interesting that what died out was Egypt as an empire, what died out was Rome as an empire, what died out was Babylon as an empire, what died out was Assyria as an empire, but the people of God have not died out. And there's a statement over in the book of Hebrews chapter 12 and in verse 28. And there it says, therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken. And I think that's in a context of all kingdoms that can be shaken. And particularly, I think that's in a context of what was left of the Jewish state when the Hebrew writer writes that the temple was still standing and the priesthood was still there. But in a very short period of time, that would all be shaken and no longer standing. But the church, the kingdom of God, the family of God on earth, is an unshaken, unending sort of entity. You know what? We don't lose. Joseph didn't lose. Daniel did not lose. The remnant in the time of Elijah, they did not lose. In the book of Revelation chapter 3, there's this statement there. First of all, in verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. What is that all about? I think that's about permanency. That you are always going to be there, that you're not going to be removed. There's a lot of modern movements out there today, but they're not pillars. They're things that come and go. It's the ebb and flow. It's the pendulum goes this way and the pendulum goes that way. But the Christian is a pillar in the temple of God. Verse 21, he who overcomes, I will grant to him to sit down with me on my throne. That does not sound like I lose if I remain with Christ. It sounds like I'm victorious. How many times in the book of Revelation is a statement made like in verse 7 of chapter 2, to him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is the paradise of God. To overcome is to be victorious. You're the victor. You win. And that's the promise for God's people. No, you're not going to lose. You win. There are times where it looks like we're behind. And there are times it looks like that we're so far behind that people start leaving the stands. Get in their cars. Get out before everyone clogs up the parking garage. And then there's that fourth quarter that the team that was behind by 20 or 30 points comes roaring back. And all the people that left are in their cars hearing about the comeback on the radio on their way home. And just kind of keep that in mind. In the book of Matthew chapter 25, verse 31, but when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on His right and the goats on the left. And the King will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. That's your win. That's your win. And that's, if you stay with God, that's certain. If you stay with God, you might say that's in the bag. In the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16, therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. That's winning. Hebrews 11, the list of people that were faithful in the Old Testament. Chapter 12, verse 1 says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses. And that cloud of witnesses includes, of course, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and the angels. But in that chapter, it includes also those like Abel, and Enoch, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and the people that follow after that, including David. Can you come up with a better list than that? American history has some people. I mean, Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln. There's some amazing people in our past that we could put in there of men that have done, people that have done great things. But it was also people that not necessarily, not all the time were believers. And it was a number of people that would certainly have moral shortcomings in their lives. I mean, in the past century, we had amazing people, like we had Eisenhower, and we had MacArthur, and we had people that accomplished great things and showed tremendous acts of courage, along with women. And so, America, but do you know of anyone that could come up with a better list? Do you know of any culture that could come up with a better list of heroes than Hebrews 11 has? I mean, I would challenge another culture to say, what are your great names? What were the great names of the Roman Empire? What were the great names of the Greek Empire? What were the great names of the Babylonian or the Assyrian Empire? What were the great names of all those cultures? What have been the great names of the English, British culture? What have been the great names of the French culture, etc.? And what have been the great names of the American culture? And I don't think you have a greater list than Hebrews 11. I think that list tops anybody's list. Because certainly other cultures have had their men and women that have been courageous and explorers and things like that. But these people are not just courageous. They were people of faith and of deep moral character as well. An impressive list. Now, my last point. I find it ironic that people who often deny the existence of absolute truth will make the wrong side of history argument, because that's a contradiction. If there is no absolute truth, there is no wrong side. And there is no right side. That's a double-edged sword. Nothing's wrong, all is allowed, but also nothing's praiseworthy, nothing's noble, nothing's right at the same time. Yeah, there is no evil, but there's also no such thing as justice at the same time. Those things simply do not exist in a no absolute truth world. A final verdict of history, a definite right and wrong side, cannot exist with the concept of no absolute truth. The only way there can be a right side and a wrong side, if there is an absolute truth and an absolute standard that is not based on feeling, but objective. Here's the other irony. I find that often people that claim to be nonconformists, I'm not going to let anyone tell me what to do. I'm a nonconformist. That often the nonconformists will make, you're going to end up on the wrong side of history. Which seems to also be a major contradiction, because isn't that the most conformist thing that you could ever do? Because isn't history down the road basically just the opinion of men? The opinion of most men. And on one side, like, wait a minute, being on the right side of history, you're almost seeming like that your goal is to please some future generation. Isn't that pleasing men? And I'm impressed that Paul said that, you know what, that's not what he does. He's just going to preach the word in season and out of season. He would also say that in verse 10 of Galatians 1, am I now seeking the favor of man or of God? Am I striving to please man? If I were trying to please man, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. And so when someone says you're going to end up on the wrong side of history, you might say, are you saying I should please men? I'm here to please God. And God makes the final verdict on history, not man. Not only that, but this, you're going to end up on the wrong side of history argument seems to be a non-Christian alternative to the final judgment. You know, at some point, history is going to have a gavel and go, you're on the right or you're on the wrong side. But wait a minute, you're kind of saying that at some point in the future, there is some final judgment about all past events. That man issues and that never changes. And we don't see that. At the end of the day, the only judgment that does matter is the one that Jesus issues. And there are people heading for the final judgment that the majority of men may say they're on the right side and they're on the wrong side. And Jesus is the one who does this. Jesus is the one who finally separates the sheep from the goats. He's the one who issues the final verdict. And while the majority stood at a precise position in time is meaningless as far as truth is concerned. All that matters is this, John 12:48. He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who judges him. The word I spake is what will judge him at the last day. And 2 Corinthians chapter 5 has the same sort of emphasis. That is, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. That's the only one occupying that seat. Men are not occupying that seat. Opinions not occupying that seat. And as Jesus sits on his throne and judges, as he's on that judgment seat, he is not looking at what do the people think. What do men believe? What's popular? He's not looking at that. He's not considering that. He said we were going to be judged based on what he taught. We're going to be judged based on his revelation. So, then it says in verse 11, therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade men. That is, that when someone says, hey, you're going to end up on the wrong side of history, you might say, you know, you're fighting the wrong battle right now. Let me help you. Let me help you. That's rather meaningless and pointless. And you need to make sure you end up on the right side of God. But then let me pause a little bit. 2,000 years later, the early Christians, are they on the right or wrong side of history? I would argue that the early Christians are on the right side of history. That is, that most people, even today, or from that point, have considered the early Christians not villains. But the early Christians don't think the villain is Nero. And I think most people say, yeah, that's the villain. The villain was the empire. History, I think, has come down very favorably on the side of the early Christians. I've lived 60 years. Sexual revolution that we went through in the 60s. What's the verdict of history on that? Were Christians right or wrong on that? I think increasingly we're run into a number of people that are going to realize, you know what? The people that followed the Bible and went to their churches and followed the Bible and said, you know what? No, sex outside of marriage is not a good thing. It's not right. Living together is not a good thing. As we've seen all the evidence come in from the last 40, 50, 60 years and the mess, pretty much isn't a consensus of history leaning towards, you know, I think the Christians may have had a point. No-fault divorce of the 70s. Okay, we saw that. What's the verdict of history on that one right now, do you think, some 30, 40 years later? I've seen a number of books written by non-Christians saying, you know what? That was not a good idea. It didn't fix anything. And what was promised at the time did not show up. You know, and I don't know what, in the 90s, number of sermons about the dangers of the internet, number of preachers have given sermons on the dangers of pornography. Where's history kind of coming down on that right now, do you think? Do you think most people are saying like, oh, you guys on pornography, you're just overreacting and a bunch of bumpuses? Or do you think more and more people are going like, you know, I think you might have a point. I think you had a good point there to warn us about that. So I even in my lifetime, I kind of seen a number of people that are non-Christians saying, you know, you Christians, maybe I don't want to live like you guys do and submit to Jesus Christ, but, you know, you're not as ignorant as I thought you were. Maybe your Bible has a lot more wisdom in it than I'm giving you credit for. So, I don't know, it just seems that sometimes people will say, you're going to be on the wrong side of history just about the time that things shift. And even history says, you know what? You might want to take a look at what those Christians were saying, because he had some really good points. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. You know, the Christians were right. You're not going to live forever. And eternity's out there. And it really looks like there may be a creator out there. Interesting thing, years ago we were told that on evolution. Man, if you guys don't get on the evolution bandwagon, you're going to be on the wrong side of history. You know, the interesting thing to me that I see in secular circles is that creation's not in trouble, evolution's in trouble. With a lot of evolutionists doubting it. You live long enough, you see things change. And you see God proven right over and over again. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. There's even a number of people in the religious world that are kind of coming around to, you know what? Mark 16:16, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Baptism now saves you. Those verses are in the Bible. You need to do them. I think Jesus is serious there. You need to be baptized.